I'm Christopher Layton, and this is Open Source. On the matter of getting over 9/11, what would it take to see ourselves as others see us in Robert Burns' prayer? Yesterday, we spoke with the writer Pico Iyer. I think of him as our eyes and ears on the global culture. He had Indian parents, an English boyhood, American university education, and now citizenship. He's married to a Japanese woman, and his home base now is rural Japan, though his career is traveling to the far places, Somalia, Iran, Latin America, on recent assignments. We caught him on a Skype phone on a visit to his parents' house in Santa Barbara, California. Pico Iyer, I began, you're everywhere, always among thoughtful people at the far ends of the earth. How are we Americans looking to the rest of the world in this long post-traumatic time?
I do feel, as many of us do, that our country's grown more and more isolated from the world in the last 13 years. And even as we're living in an ever more connected globe, we can sometimes seem in this country to be more disconnected than ever. And so it strikes me that whenever I go to an interesting country, I meet Germans and Canadians and Brits and Israelis and Australians and pretty much the entire world, including more and more Chinese, and almost never an American. And it worries me that in this global neighborhood, where, as in any neighborhood, the first sensible thing is to go and get to know the neighbors, we seem to be further and further from the world at large. And I think in any neighborhood, if there's one person who locks the door and draws the blinds and hides behind the sofa, that person is both most threatening to the other neighbors and in the least possible useful position. So I wish that we did have more contact, and I wish that 9/11 hadn't pushed us back into our isolation, but in fact had brought us into the wider world more.
What is the 9/11 effect?
The effect here seems to be fear and greater distance. And, you know, I think the U.S. is obviously a young country, and it's a very charmed country, and I'm chosen to live here because I think it's a remarkable privilege that we have had and I've had to spend, let's say, 50 years without a war around us at home. And I think there must be very few people in all of history who could say that they've enjoyed that great blessing. But the drawback is that I think we can be very undefended and not able necessarily to deal with reality quite as resiliently as we might. And I think part of our problem is, because of this isolation, not having a sense of history and not having a sense of geography very much. It struck me that I was flying to Canada the week of September 11th, and the minute I touched down in Ottawa, everyone around me was putting that terrible event into a global context and into a historical context. Of course, Canada wasn't the direct target of the attack, so maybe it was a little easier for them. But nonetheless, I wish that we were in a position to see isolated events as not isolated, but as part of a larger kind of sequence of cause and effect.
What's the deficit here, Pico, in our global and historical sense?
Well, I suppose it's partly in a result of good fortune that we haven't had to be implicated in the world in the same way as the European nations have been for hundreds of years. But I do think these days it makes ever less sense that we all know that we're more and more a part of this global body. And yet, whether it's the newspapers and TV shows that give us less news about the globe, or the fact that the Americans are still traveling much less proportionally than any other nation, I think it leaves us ever more vulnerable in all kinds of ways. And you know, one of the first articles I ever wrote as a journalist 30 years ago was on the assassin group in Iran in the 11th century, who patented with cunning efficiency this terrifying notion that if there's a very small group that wants to keep its to hold its own against a much larger group, just a single chilling attack can traumatize that larger group for life. And in a curious way, because of our size as a nation, our enemies can see that not as a strength but as a vulnerability, that there are more ways to get at us and that we don't know how to respond when an evil force provokes us, as it were. So I do feel that the more we harp on our wounds and our sufferings of recent years, the more, of course, the terrorists can gloat and think that we are our response is beyond their wildest dreams. So I do worry about this isolation, and I spend a lot of time in the Middle East and beautiful parts of the Middle East like Iran and Oman and Jordan. And whenever I'm there, I look around at all the people who've come there from every last corner of the world to get to know these places. And I wonder why my neighbors in California, who do tend to have the means and time to travel, aren't there.
You've got a wonderful eye, Pico, for the writers we haven't read yet, coming now from all over the world. What's the news?
Well, I'm thrilled that our writing has grown much more global, as, of course, has our food and our culture generally. And if you were to look at American literature right now and the most exciting young writers, I think the majority of them have names that we can't pronounce. In other words, are coming from very different lands, bringing their own histories and their own ways of telling stories into our midst, and in some ways trying to bring us into the global community, whether it's Edwige Dantica from Haiti or Chimamanda Adichie Negosi Adichie from Nigeria, or Juno Diaz from the Dominican Republic, or Gary Steingart from Russia, or hundreds of others. I think they're all trying to widen our imaginations and to remind us of our connections with a larger world outside. And I think all of that is to the good. Again, our literature is a reflection of the fact that the United States is ever more a global nation, and our student population is still a reflection of that too. Our cities are ever more mongrel and mixed up in wonderful and creatively liberating ways. I think it's just our sensibility and our habits that perhaps could be reformed a little or encouraged to look outwards. And I think the more we look outwards, the stronger we will be in dealing with the almost inevitable tragedies that we are going to have to deal with, if not from a terrorist attack, then from an act of nature.
I wonder, too, if our political class, even our public conversation and our media, aren't lagging way behind.
Very much so. I mean, of course, the blessing of the present moment is you or I sitting in this country has access to the media of the rest of the world, and I think more and more people are using that. But everywhere I go in the world, from the smallest country to the large, whether it's Cuba or Iran or Bhutan, I find that the people I meet there know much more about us than we know about them. I was traveling in Iran a few months ago, and within 10 minutes of my arrival in the country, in Mashhad at the dead of night, people were talking to me about John Stewart and pointing out people along the streets that they said looked like John Cleese. And I turned on the TV in my hotel room, and there was Piers Morgan on CNN. And I thought, well, these guys are very plugged into what's going on here, which for cultural reasons, but maybe also for geopolitical ones. And very few of my friends in this country know anything about what's going on in Iran. And I think there is a cause and effect between knowledge and inner strength. One of the things that struck me when I was in Iran was that I asked my guide there at one point if he'd ever been to the city of Bam. And he said he'd actually been there at the time of devastating earthquake 10 or 11 years ago that wiped out that city and killed 30,000 people. And he said that at that time he'd been traveling with a European tour group. And of course, it's any tour guide's worst nightmare. They were staying on a four-story hotel. The top two stories completely collapsed. They were on the second floor. He had to lead them out at dead of night into the tour bus, which was the only safe place. They were sitting in the middle of this ruined city, and they knew that they couldn't offer much help. There were more experienced and trained people who would be doing that. And they just cowered in the dark, and once the light came up, these Europeans said, well, let's go on with our tour. And he cited that just as an example to me of how he felt that the European culture was used to dealing with tragedy and horror, and therefore fairly resilient. And there were other cultures that perhaps were not so. And of course, that was an act of God or an act of nature rather than an act of terrorism. But nonetheless, how we deal with whatever sufferings come to us is in part a function of how much we know about the world.
Pico Ira, I think of wonderful conversations you and I have had over the years, specifically about Graham Greene, the novelist, you call him the man inside your head, and the Dalai Lama, whom you knew growing up. What would majestic minds like those make of the American performance at this point?
Yes, well, Graham Greene, of course, wrote The Quiet American, which is almost an elegy to American innocence. And of course, the main character there, arriving in Saigon in the early 1950s, is full of idealism, full of the theories that he's learned in Harvard Yard, full of good intentions. But as a result of all that, makes a mess of everything he touches. Now, the Europeans in that book, who are at the other extreme, extremely disengaged, detached, and even cynical, are no better than he. But I think when you read a book like The Quiet American about the danger of innocence and of good intentions, you can understand something about perhaps what's taking place even now in our foreign policy. And as for the Dalai Lama, I think one of the great messages that he carries around the world in his travels is about the dangers of isolation. And he often will say that old Tibet, where he grew up, was asking for trouble because it was so isolated from the real world. And he often says that exile and the suffering that he and his people have had to deal with for the last 60 years has one good quality, which is that it has forced him and his people to really look at reality and to deal with what's going on and to get to know the larger world. And he, since long before the environmental movement and globalism and all the terms we throw around now, has been stressing from his Buddhist point of view this notion of interconnectedness. What happens in Beijing is going to have consequences in Washington. What we do now will have consequences in Lagos or Bangalore. And therefore, we can't begin to see our own situation outside the context of all the other factors of whom we are a part. And so I think he's just trying to open our eyes to our larger responsibilities. You know, the scariest country I've ever traveled to was North Korea, and that's because it was the most sealed. And when I was walking around Pyongyang, the capital, I had the distinct sense that it was really hard for any North Korean to imagine how life might be in London or Paris or Los Angeles. And I would hate for those of us in this country, with all our many freedoms and opportunities to get to know the rest of the world, to be in even a small version of that same situation. And for us, let's say in Southern California, not to know what it's like to live in Tehran or Paris or Moscow or wherever it happens to be.
Pico, what's the best movie or book or poem or song you've heard commenting on the moment? I can't get that movie Her out of my head. It's not exactly a post 9/11 statement, but it is sort of welcome to a digital century. And it's both funny and scary and charming and mysterious all at once. How'd you like it?
My heavens, yeah, as ever, you take the words out of my mouth. As soon as I came back to California in December, I'm a huge movie goer. I went to see about 20 movies, and Her was far and away the one that stayed with me. And I have no interest in technology, and I haven't always been a fan of the director or the main actor in that. And I went in expecting a sort of strange dystopian movie, and I came away more touched and more provoked and more expanded than by any movie in a long time. And as you say, I don't think it really has to do with our geopolitical situation, but it's a wonderful, emotional, touching movie, and I loved the look of it. And of course, one of the interesting things about seeing Her in Southern California was to look at this extraordinary vision of Los Angeles and say to myself, I don't know which part of L.A. they could have shot that in, and to find in the final credits that the only way they could reproduce Los Angeles 5 years from now is by going to Shanghai. And in that sense, I think it speaks to my larger sense, which is that as long as you're in only in the United States, it's hard to fathom how far ahead into the future Shanghai or Tokyo or much of Europe is. And I know many of my friends around me in California who haven't traveled still have this sense that America is the world's leader when it comes to culture or technology or efficiency. And the minute they were to get out of the plane in Zurich or London or Shanghai, they would see that we're 15 years behind and falling ever further behind. And in a tiny way, that movie brought that point home to us.
I thought Tom Hanks's Captain Phillips was a pretty wonderful movie about this time and the confrontation of superpower America with the kind of desperate energy and anger of the starving Somalians.
Yes, Captain Phillips. The Somali man says so memorably, "I am the captain now." And you know, I thought that movie did a great job, apart from anything else, of again of showing us how things look from the Somali point of view. And I remember there's that wonderful moment towards the end where Tom Hanks, I think, asks him something like, well, "You know, why are you doing this? There's so much else you could be doing in life." And he says something like, "Well, for you, there is." For somebody in Somalia, there isn't. And although I haven't been to Somalia, I've been to Yemen and Ethiopia and other countries around there. And I commend that movie for beginning to show us how, if you have such limited opportunities as those people over there do, the world is going to look radically different from the way it looks to a Tom Hanks. And using the imaginative medium of film to get into the other and to so that it's not America looking at Somalia, but again and again in that film, we see how Somalia might look at America. You know, I've got to say that I think Hollywood has done a wonderful job since 9/11 of trying to penetrate the other, trying to understand the political situation from the other side of the world. I just saw Syriana again, and I think again and again our movies have shown the Islamic world in all its sophistication and intelligence and in Syriana or in Body of Lies, even with Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe, the Jordanian intelligence is presented as knowing much more about things than the American intelligence. So again, culturally, whether it's literature or movies, I think we've got with the program, and a lot of individuals are very plugged in to the rest of the world. It's just getting the whole body politic, as it were, in sync with the vision of those individuals. So it's, so many Americans have as good a sense as anybody of where the global world is going. It's just America as a whole that isn't sufficiently represented.
I'm thinking of the last Star Trek movie, Into Darkness, with Zachary Quinto playing Mr. Spock. I felt even there that a very popular movie was tuned to the dangers of intervention, the dangers of overreacting to a terrorist threat, as our media and our politics are not.
Makes absolute sense to me. I mean, I think of Star Trek as a product of the 60s, and even then it was about both exploration into the unknown and wariness towards Southeast Asia, as it was in the late 60s. So, yes, it makes absolute sense to me that Star Trek would be foreign policy sensitive, and it's largely about how the other is. I can't remember the name of the movie. Maybe it was Traitor, but there was one about Don Cheadle that I saw a few years ago that again suggested that at some level it's very, very difficult for us to tell who's the enemy and who's the friend. And the one takeaway from that is just to be slower about judging the other because we read him so badly. And again, I think maybe it's partly because Hollywood and culture generally is drawn to complexity and ambiguity and those places where there aren't answers. And I think that's what we need more and more in a world where we're surrounded by people from other cultures who are very difficult for us to read, not just linguistically, but in every other sense. And so we have to be much slower about imposing our presuppositions upon them. And I think culture does that very well, and politics perhaps less so. Maybe politicians don't have the luxury of being able to handle many opposing ideas at the same time.
Pico, we're going to take their guns away and let the musicians run the world.
In our defense, I do think this is a global situation, which is that across the world, individuals and cultures tend to be much wiser than their governments. And so if you were to go to Iran or Syria or many another country now, you would hear exactly the same thing, which is that so many individuals have a nuanced sense of the world and of America and of the other, but the governments are stuck to their own us against them way of perceiving things. And I think it's a great glory of the imagination that it doesn't have to be hostage to that notion that one body's success is another body's failure. It's not caught up in the divisive rivalries of governments or corporations. So, yes, our government is behind our culture, but that's probably the case everywhere from Beijing to Tehran as well. But, you know, one reason that I think the cultural figures have this power is that, of course, they travel so much. And I think if you look at somebody like Bono, the reason that he's clued up around the world is that his job involves traveling constantly about it. And same way as architects have a very grounded tactical sense of divisions of everywhere from Arabia to China. So I hope there may be some way in which our political leaders can get that same opportunity.
That's a fascinating idea, Pico, that Hollywood is dependent on foreign rights and foreign income. So in effect, foreign audiences get to vote on our popular culture as they don't on our politics.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I suppose Hollywood is dependent on the global audience in a way that our politicians might not be. But nonetheless, when I think back to, let's say, Rambo, the huge global hit when I first began traveling the world 30 years ago, it was very, very jingoistic. It was all about America beating everybody up in Afghanistan and coming out triumphant. And I do think that even our blockbusters now are much more questioning and nuanced. And of course, America has been humbled in the last 30 years, but I think that new humility and even agnosticism is evident in the Hollywood movies, even forgetting that they're aimed at a foreign audience in a way that it hasn't always been in our politics. And of course, that speaks more for the political system than perhaps for our politicians, because as you know, you and I have spoken before, when the current president came into office, I thought if there's one person who really has a global view, and I still believe that on the basis of his writing, it's Mr. Obama. He's the ideal person to see the world through the eyes of the other, whether the Kenyan other or the Indonesian other or the Hawaiian other or the Islamic other. But nonetheless, even for somebody as global as he, it's been very difficult to operate in a system that seems ever more entrenched and unglobal.
And Zadie Smith touched on it when she wrote Barack Obama up as a writer. You wonder, why is President Obama so much more liberated as a writer than as a politician?
Well, I know as a writer myself, and you as a writer too, we only have to, you know, satisfy ourselves, we're our own boss. And of course, the politician is exactly the opposite. But I think I know that, you know, your former employer, the New York Times, or my sometime employer, Time Magazine, which are two of the great organs for bringing the world to the United States, I'm guessing in both cases have far fewer foreign bureaus than they did 30 years ago, even though our destinies are much more dependent on foreign concerns now than they were then. So it's a curious thing that as our lives grow more global, our media coverage in this country seems to grow less so.
That was Pico Iyer, the man who sort of lives at 30,000 feet, ever traveling around the world and taking good notes. You can search on our website for a lot more Pico Iyer, and he's always interesting. Kunal Jasti produced and edited this conversation with Pico Iyer. Add your comment, please, on our site, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.